Hey folks, Ethan here with a quick but thrilling commercial interruption. On April 18th at 3 p.m. Pacific time, 6 p.m. Eastern, we are hosting a masterclass on action geometry with the renowned Dean Rayburn. We host these masterclasses pretty much every third Thursday of every month. You don't want to miss them. You don't want to miss this one. This masterclass will be two extensive parts. Part one will dive into the basics of grand piano action geometry. You can master meticulous measurement techniques to determine radial arms, key ratios, and understand important calculations. In part two, you can apply your knowledge to real-world piano action problems. Dean demonstrates practical solutions, including the magic line concept and hammer weight reduction methods. Key features of this lecture include hands-on style learning with Dean Rayburn, a titan of the piano industry, in-depth coverage of action geometry principles and problem-solving techniques, real-world application through troubleshooting and solution demonstrations, and expert insights from Dean Rayburn. That's 45 years of experience in the piano industry. Dean is a seasoned RPT, certified tuning examiner, and a lifelong piano aficionado. With Dean, you are certainly learning from the best. So don't forget to sign up. Visit bit.ly/piano action for more details and secure your spot. That's bit.ly/piano action, bit.ly/piano action.
Hello, and welcome to Piano Tech Radio Hour, the weekly bridge to the future of the piano tech community. I'm David Anderson.
And I'm Ethan Janney. And we're here to ask great questions, and then we'll shut up and listen to some of the authorities, experts, and most outstanding personalities in our little world of pianos.
So, put on your best set of headphones, and let's get started.
You can just join us here if you want to hop over. And in the meantime, it looks like we got a pretty good collection of folks here. I have to say this up front, David Anderson sends his apologies for not attending today. He is feeling quite under the weather, and that's saying a lot for David Anderson. So we appreciate him sending his best wishes and hope he feels better before next time. He's been consistently here through thick and thin. So. Yeah, I think it'll be in his best interest to take a rest. And I'll take a second to apologize for last week. Boaz Kirschenbaum was actually sick as well. Strange times we're in, people. Sickness feels a little bit different than it typically does. But yeah, we're going to move ahead today with Bill Monroe. I'm going to start giving some introductions. And first thing I'll do is tell you how we came to be here today. We were brought to you by Piano Tech Radio Hour. Piano Tech Radio Hour is being brought to you by Piano Technicians Masterclasses, an online educational resource that offers you cutting-edge instruction from piano industry masters without leaving your home. You can find out more at www.pianotechniciansmasterclass.com. And I'll introduce today's guest. That's Bill Monroe. Bill specializes in rebuilding grand pianos. Say that again. Bill specializes in rebuilding grand pianos. After graduating from school at Montana State University in Bozeman in wildlife ecology, his career took a detour in the year 1999 when he decided to tune pianos full time. He's the owner of A440 Piano Services in Belleville, Wisconsin. He is a top piano technician in the industry with over 20 years of experience. And we decided that today we could cover a bunch of different topics, and we'll sift through the ones that might be of interest, and you all are welcome to add your thoughts and questions and guide the conversation. So Bill, officially, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here. It's my pleasure.
And you have quite an organized looking shop back there, which is quite impressive.
It's the one part that's put together. If I turned the screen around, you'd see the rest of the chaos.
Oh, got it. I kind of wanted you to maintain the fantasy for me. My shop is flawlessly organized. I have a 1 hour routine every evening where I put everything in its place. Sure. I was actually, when I visited North Bennett Street School and talk with Lou Delbaney, I was actually impressed that they had some pretty serious protocols for cleaning up the shops at that school on a regular basis. Although I think he did admit that it wasn't as typically as clean as it was when I visited.
Yeah, well, I joke about it a little bit, but yeah, I do tend to keep things pretty organized. I'm a bit of a type A personality in that respect, and I don't like having to clean stuff up to get things started. So I do tend to keep things quite clean. I have a household vacuum that I run out here because it's just, I need to keep things really clean, and my space is huge. So yeah, organization does tend to be of importance.
Awesome. That's great. I'm curious then on that topic, maybe that's a good place to get started. So it sounds like you've always been relatively organized. And I know for myself, I go off and on. I'm kind of going through a sort of half high organization, half total disorganization period, where I have some things that are kind of really have a system going on, and then I have some other things that I'm on the seat of my pants by. But yeah, I'm just curious, like, let's talk about when you started rebuilding pianos. You probably had to build your shop at that point. How much of thought did you put into how you're going to organize your shop and put things together and where everything will go and how it gets put away?
Quite a lot, actually. I'm fortunate when I first started rebuilding, I, like a lot of techs, I think I was working out of my home. I had a two-car garage that I sort of converted over and kicked the vehicles out to begin doing some restoration work there. And that kind of, I got my feet wet doing that, I think, developed some ideas about what was going to be important to me as a rebuilder, things I needed to add to my shop, things I didn't need to have. And I had probably 2 to 3 years, probably 2 years with that type of a setup. So then when we moved to the location I'm at now, part of the reason we moved here was that there was room to build a shop. And so I was fortunate in that respect where I was able to come in, clear the ground and start from the ground up. And actually myself, my father-in-law and my grandfather-in-law did about 90% of the building of the shop itself. So we really were able to sort of customize everything from the ground up. One of the things that I added, which I found really helpful, as we poured the concrete, we put in ductwork underneath the concrete for dust collection. So all of that was run, covered, and, you know, we had a couple of places where the connections would pop up out of the, either out of the floor at where I have the station or out of the walls, so that part of the mess was taken care of, and I didn't have to worry about that too much. And again, I think not everybody's fortunate enough to be able to have some experience doing it and then be able to design their own shop. And that was a nice bonus for me.
Wow. Yeah. That's pretty great. So you're telling me you put custom tubing underneath or within the concrete so that the dust collection could be taken care of that way.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, I kind of had envisioned how I wanted to have my machine layout. And particularly there was an island that has my table saw and a router table and a jointer and a planer all kind of in the center space of that area. And then there's one of the dust collection connections pops up out of the concrete in the middle of those things. So everything is just ducted right there to the middle. And everything then runs underneath the concrete to the dust collection system over on the wall. Yeah, very, very efficient. And the only challenge with having something like that is that you have to make sure you keep up on your cleanliness and cleaning out the ductwork periodically, because it's not something you can just access should you have a problem.
Are you a spreadsheet guy? How do you keep track of the things that you do or routines? Is it daily stuff, weekly stuff?
In terms of like rebuilding work, you mean?
Anything, to be honest. I'm just curious on this topic of organization. You talked about cleaning out the ductwork. Is it just kind of when it happens, it happens? Is it something that you have a schedule for?
A schedule probably is a good idea. I'm not that organized. I do consider myself kind of a spreadsheet guy, and I have a lot of stuff that is organized either that way or more typically I use Google Apps program actually for a lot of my organizational purposes, and just kind of everything is in one place there. And so calendar is very helpful for me to just kind of throw things on the calendar. If they're repeated events, it's very easy to do that way. And that way I've got a reminder when I have to do stuff like that. So I do tend to write things down that way or keep it digitally these days.
Let's shoot into rebuilding. Sure. Tell me about the percentage of work that you're doing. Well, you can say pre-COVID because I know things have changed a lot, but you can also put things in perspective. But in terms of time spent in a typical week, month, year, you know, it could be seasonal, I don't know. Where do you put your time in field work versus rebuilding stuff at this point?
Sure, it's a good question. And week to week, it's exceptionally variable. But on average, about 50-50, about half my time is spent in the shop. The other half the time is spent out in the field doing work like that, tuning basic repairs and that kind of a thing. And for me, because I'm the only person that works for me, anything that I generate as far as shop work is concerned, any rebuilding or bigger projects has to come from, for the most part, from clientele that I'm already servicing in the field and just generating business that way. I will say, too, that having a good web presence has helped. I have started getting jobs, like in the last 5 years, really, have enough of a web presence and I guess enough of a network that I am starting to get calls, just cold calls, people calling about extended rebuilding and that kind of a thing. But that certainly is less common than generating the work for myself from field service calls.
And I think the one thing that I've noticed as a technician, and I see this happens with other technicians as well. I don't know. I'd probably put a number on at least 50 to 75% of technicians have a fantasy of rebuilding pianos. It's kind of sounds romantic. And, you know, once from my perspective, at least, especially when I was living in New York City, when it was like, how could I possibly have a shop space, afford it? It starts to become, you know, an overwhelming thing to think about. And then I've got overhead, I've got rent. Do these things really make sense? Like I would take on jobs and I would price it out. Maybe I would feel like it wasn't worth it in the end after I did it in terms of the income. Maybe it was rewarding. I'm just curious in terms of how you think about or how your ideas have evolved about offering services to people, making sure that you'll come out on top. Maybe you don't always. What are your thoughts on bidding out work and deciding what to recommend or take on?
Sure. That's a really big question, and I'll try to keep my answer as organized as possible.
And you don't have to have the right answer, by the way. I'm not trying to place you on a pedestal that you know everything, but I think your perspective is going to be interesting to people for sure.
No, and I appreciate that. And I'll be the first one to say that there's lots of ways to go about this work, and the way that I do it works for me in the area that I live, and I think in big part because of things like I'm in the Midwest, I live in a small town, I'm within a half hour of the giant city of Madison, Wisconsin, which really isn't that big, and my shop is at my home. It's property that we already own, and so I don't have that sort of overhead, and that makes a big difference in how you approach these things. That said, I think early on in my career, I made the mistake of concerning myself with customers' perspective of my pricing, and by that I mean I was hesitant to charge what it really cost to do the work and make sure that I was making money in the process, because I was afraid that I would be perceived as overcharging or nickel and diming folks or that kind of a thing just to line my pocketbooks. And I think that's one of the realities that anybody wanting to get into rebuilding needs to come to terms with, is just recognizing that, you know, unless you want it to be a hobby for you, which most of us, I don't think that's our intent. If you don't want it to be a hobby, then you need to be very forthright and very unapologetic about what it actually costs you to do that work, in terms of, like you bring up, these ideas of overhead. If you don't have a shop on your property, you've got to figure that in. It costs money to maintain a shop. It costs money to do estimates. It costs money to do all the parts of the things that go into rebuilding. So as the years went by, I started kind of developing this perspective that enabled me to be able to submit estimates for people without worrying about what they thought about it, because that was my reality. And if I couldn't get folks to buy a rebuilding job for X amount of dollars, then I didn't want that job, effectively, because it was going to cost me more than I was going to make. And so, you know, I think you do have to come to terms with that, however it works for you. And again, it's different for everybody, I think, in that perspective, but you do need to be smart about it and make sure that you're making money doing that work. And if you're not, you either need to change your charging structure, or you need to decide maybe that's not what you want to be doing to be profitable. And I, you know, that can be a hard thing to, a hard pill to swallow sometimes.
Right. Yeah, I appreciate your forthrightness with this. And just because I know, I'm kind of digging in on what I think is a little bit of a tough question, so feel free to say uncle or something. But because I think people will be interested. I'm interested to hear about it, and I think people will be interested in the details. I have a question here I'll get to in a minute. Looks like somebody's writing in the chat. But so it sounds like, in terms of how you're imagining the work you do, it's coming from a perspective of, I like what I do. I'm good at what I do. And in order for me to make a living at it, this is how much I charge. So there's the estimate. And then it's the client's decision whether they want to do it or not. Do you factor in to that at all? Or is it a distraction to think, is it worth it for the client? Like, you know, does this add this value to your piano so that you can resell it later? I know a lot of people think in those terms, but I don't know that it makes sense. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's another really big topic, and we could probably talk about that for the next hour and a half or 2 hours or whatever. But yeah, let me back up a little bit from that first, and just kind of, again, in the last few years, I've been working on this business philosophy of, I like to title it, it's not up to you. Meaning it's not up to me as a technician. And what I mean by that is I've kind of made a paradigm shift in how I view myself as a technician, particularly when it comes to bigger jobs, restoration work and rebuilding, but also with everyday stuff, in feeling that my role as a piano technician is not just to come in and tune somebody's piano or tell them what's broken, but I really need to embrace, and I really have embraced, that role of educator with my clients, and trying to give them as much information as possible, as much information as they want to hear. Some clients don't want to hear a lot. Others are, you could talk for weeks about pianos with. But I think it's really important for me to share with my clients as much as I can share with them about their piano, where it's at, where it could be at, and what it costs to get it there, in as much or as little detail as they want to hear. And then in doing, and this is something that I do for a Lester Spinet or a Fazioli, you know, it doesn't matter what the piano is. The point is getting across to that client where they are with their piano, where they could be, what it costs to get there. And then the follow-up question to that is it worth it? And I think that question of, is it worth it, is a loaded question. I think you can think of that in a couple of different ways. One way to think of, is it worth it, is from a market perspective. Does it make sense if I put X amount of dollars into this piano? Am I going to get X dollars in return, or some percentage of that X dollars that I've spent? And weighing it on those merits is reasonable. It's not mutually exclusive, however, of deciding whether or not it's musically worth it, for example. And I've done restoration jobs on upright pianos, rebuilding jobs, full-on rebuilding jobs of upright pianos that, from a market perspective, absolutely cannot justify the work. You know, by the time you put in $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 into a piano that's an upright piano on the market, you know, unless you find the right buyer, that's not going to sell for more than 10. So from an investment perspective or a market perspective, absolutely not worth it. But from a musical perspective, you put that kind of money into an old upright, rebuild it properly and well, and that instrument is going to perform as well or better than a comparable new instrument that you're paying $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 for, that's of that similar size and performance value. So I think there's that. That's a second perspective in thinking about it. A third perspective is, what does it matter to the client? And is there sentimental value attached with that instrument? And how much does that weigh into the equation? And I think all of those things are valid considerations. And I think so long as you have been very good at your job of educating that client about all of these details, then the decision to rebuild or not rebuild whatever instrument, that then goes over to them. It's not up to me to make that choice. It's up to them to make that choice with the best information available to them. And I think where we get in trouble with that is when we selectively give our client information and we just kind of lead them into a place where we think makes sense, as opposed to just giving them that information and letting them make the choice. And the really cool thing about that process for me is that I've learned how to give estimates to clients unapologetically and share information about their pianos unapologetically and not worry about how I'm being perceived, because I think pretty quickly they understand you're just there to educate and share with them. And then whatever approach they want to take, for the most part, that I'm perfectly happy with that, because it's their piano. And if they have the right information and they choose to go whichever way with it, that's fine. It's their piano and they need to live with it. And I like to let them make the choice.
Yep. I see that perspective. It's about education and about letting them make the decision. I'm going to go to a comment here in the chat. We'll see if there's anything. Oh, it has the word discuss at the end. I like that. It's like coffee talk from Saturday Night Live. The fact that we make money from rebuilding is frankly a conflict of interest. Often, the result of major work on a not top quality instrument is questionable, and the owner would be better off putting the money towards a new or better instrument. Discuss. That's from Bill Magnuson.
Yeah, and so I think there's a couple things that kind of come into that perspective, and one is, I think if the client has that information, they already know that. And so we don't have to make that choice for them. I think where you run into that, or where you get into that sort of trouble of getting substandard results from something when they really would be better off spending their money on a newer instrument, is when you haven't been forthright about what those other options are. But if I come to you as a client and I say, hey, you know, we could put X amount of dollars into this piano, here's the result you're gonna have. And be very clear about, and I've had this conversation numerous times with folks where, you know, we could put, say, $1,500 or $2,000 into an old piano, and it's 100 years old, and that'll make it work again. But when they're done, they've still got a 100-year-old piano with 100-year-old parts that are worn, substandard, and it certainly will not perform like a newer instrument. And if they have that information, but they love this piano and they want to keep it, and so they just want it to run, well, that's not my decision to make. And it may be for me, I may agree with that perspective entirely, saying, look, you're wasting your money here, and I'll tell them that. Not that they're wasting their money, but that if your primary concern is musicality and having a well-functioning instrument in your home, you're not best served by investing in this piano. You're best served by investing in a newer used instrument or a new instrument. And again, once they have that information, now it's not my choice to make. Because if they know the results are going to be substandard, even if we do the best we can, and that's what they want to do, then it's a judgment call. And that's not something that I can make. So yeah, I think you can get into that trouble if it's muddied, if you're selective about how you present things and so on. But ultimately, it's the client's call on how they want to pursue that.
I would just add this, and you know, I'm not an expert at selling we're building jobs. I've only sold a few, where I outsource it to someone who's doing some sort of rebuilding. But I do find that it's easy to ignore, as a piano technician, some of the other ways that people have value in their lives and their careers, these type of things. So a good example would be if somebody has an instrument, they're used to it, they like it, they like how it plays, maybe it has some sentimental value. They can go out and get a new piano, but there's also time and energy involved in researching which piano you're going to get. And if you want to do a cost benefit analysis on it and say, what's your time worth per hour? And you're going to go out and you're going to search and you're going to find something, and then add that on top of the cost of the new piano and having it delivered and moving things around and having a huge headache go on. There's just a point to say that there's a lot of other factors sometimes we don't consider that are going on for people who want specific work done. I'll go on to
that. And I absolutely agree with that. And I also think that, again, it's you just have to be very, very complete with your clients in this information. And it's one thing to come to a client and say, yeah, gosh, you know, your piano needs X, Y, and Z. I can do that. It'll make it better. And here's what it'll cost. And if that's all you give them, but you don't give them that contrast of, or you put it into a newer instrument, or you could, you know, look for a better used instrument, or whatever it is, you know, if you're not complete with that information, then yeah, we run the risk of lining our pockets just because we can. But I think so long as you're very thorough in your presentation and you're not leading them somewhere that you want them to go as opposed to what's in their best interest, then again, that ultimately that decision is theirs.
Yeah, I'll just extend that analogy that Bill Magnuson gave in his comment. You know, there's a collateral of saying, oh, you know what, I'm not going to tune this piano because you can get a digital keyboard and you won't have to continue to have your piano tuned every year. We're going to save you a lot of money. You're going to get a digital piano. It's going to be great. That's a matter of opinion. You know, some people will agree with that, and a lot of people do agree with that. But definitely if we're in the business of tuning pianos and people don't agree with that, then we want to tune their piano and help them maintain it and keep up with an acoustic instrument. I'm going to hit the chat here a little bit more and see what's coming up. Jim Kelly said, what do you sub out? Simple question. I'm not sure if there's much. You said you do solo work, but maybe you do keys or something like that. What do you sub out?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I do most everything in my shop. The things that I don't do as a rebuilder include refinishing. That to me is a completely different animal and not something that I want to spend the time and the very shallow learning curve of getting right, learning to do. So I sub out refinishing. I sub out making of soundboards. I don't make my own soundboards. I do get the boards in the shop and I install them here myself, but I don't make them. Aside from that, I mean, accepting things like, you know, very specialty things like making key sets. I don't make key sets. If I need a new key set, I would have that made for me. Key coverings I do, bridge caps I do, bridges I do, I mean, all of that stuff. So mainly it's of the common things that rebuilders generally would do in a shop, it's the refinishing and it's the making of soundboards that I don't do. Otherwise, yeah, pretty much everything.
Do you have someone locally that does refinishing? I guess that just would go without saying. Has it been hard to find someone locally?
No. I have one local person who's a furniture refinisher who's done dozens and dozens of pianos prior to me coming to him. And I use him periodically. It kind of depends on the job, whether I use him or I have another contact in Chicago who refinishes, has a piano shop there. So I go back and forth. It just depends on the job. So the one guy is local, the other guy is Chicago, but he makes enough trips up to Madison that it's really not difficult for me to get a job to him and back. In fact, I have one there right now.
Got it. I got my own questions, but I really want, because we do getting some comments in the chat, so I want to cater to folks who are in the audience here. I have Bill Yick, who says, often the piano has sentimental value that overrides quality. The client is willing to pay and has no plans to sell. And Mark Steiger says, yes, I tune a lot of acrosonics that people literally could not give away. Eric Johnson, welcome back. Eric said, what do doctors do with their mistakes? They bury them. Just got the joke there. What do piano rebuilders do with their mistakes? They sell them. Oh, okay. I'm not sure if there's any more comments to make about that. Carl Lieberman said, but does it ever make sense to fully rebuild any instrument other than a Steinway or other top quality piano? I think you have a fiduciary responsibility to follow this path. You've done some uprights. Are they always Steinway uprights? Do you stick to certain brands? What's your policy in terms of brands?
No, I think when you start getting into off brands, it's a question of what results you know you're able to achieve. And so again, I think this goes back to my perspective about how you look at it. And I think you do look at it from a market perspective, because that matters and that information has to be out there for a client. So if we were looking at rebuilding, which I did an A/B Chase upright at one point for a client. She really enjoyed her piano, wanted to keep it. It meant something for her. You know, I forget the amount of dollars we put into it, but again, the market value on it when it was done was a third to half that maybe. And she knew that going in. But musically, that piano is better than a Steinway K52. I mean, it looks nicer. It plays nicer. It everything about it is, in my opinion, nicer. The work was very well done, and you ended up with an incredibly musical instrument with provenance that meant something to a client who understood that should she try and turn around and sell it, she would not get what she paid for it. And her focus was to have this piano because it meant something to her, and to have an instrument that was highly musical, and those objectives were met. And so in that case, what the market value on that instrument ended up being is irrelevant, because she's made that choice. She knows, and it doesn't matter because we achieved the musicality we need. So I think so often you look at these instruments that are 100 years old now, or 110 or 120 from the early 1900s, so many of these off-brand instruments were so well made structurally. They just don't have the fallboard appeal that a Steinway or Meg and Mason and Hamlin or something like that does. That doesn't mean that they're not musically capable if you do the right work. But, you know, having said that, those are the exceptions. Those jobs don't come by very often. Most of the work that I do is Steinway, Mason and Hamlin. Every now and then Baldwin is kind of a popular one here, and I've got one actually sitting here in the shop that is ready to go out. So that gets done too. But it certainly is not out of the question to do an off-brand. You know, another one that we did, a colleague and I did 7 or 8 years ago, was a Henry F. Miller. It was an 8'9" piano. And, you know, it doesn't have the market value, but oh man, that piano is a killer. It was just fantastic. And so, yeah, my perspective on this, and again, not everybody has to subscribe to it, but my perspective is, as long as you are very, very clear on all the details about that instrument, from market value to sentimental value to musicality, and the client has that information, then it's not my choice. If there's some sort of exceptional situation where I really feel like this is just a disservice to everybody involved and somebody making an irrational choice, then I guess I would leave myself the right to bow out and not accept the job if I really was that opposed to it. But yeah, ultimately it's just really not my choice.
I noticed there's kind of maybe two main camps of people that I would consider great technicians, you know, that I really resonate with their passion for quality. And I think that there's one type that says, I decided, you know, 10 years ago, I only tune grand pianos or Steinway pianos. And they've kind of stuck with that. And that's sort of how they measure their own worth and their sort of Pension for Quality. And then there's definitely another, there's another group of technicians who maybe still mostly tune and work on those type of pianos, but they say, I, whatever piano that I work on, I make it amazing. You know, I don't say, hey, this piano is not worth it because it's not a grand piano or a Steinway piano or whatever. I'm going to give it the best energy I can. It sounds like you kind of, even though, again, you may be focusing on Steinway, Mason, Hamlin, and some of the better brands, you kind of have that approach. Have you ever thought about just saying, I'm only a Steinway rebuilder, or I, you know, I only focus on a certain threshold?
The thought has crossed my mind, but no, it's one that I tend to dismiss pretty quickly. So, and again, in my perspective, where I live plays a role in that. I live in the Midwest in a small town, and, you know, Madison is not that big. If I decided I wasn't going to take any jobs but high-end jobs, I think my the amount of work that I had would be dramatically reduced. I work on everything. I mean, literally everything, things that you see in condemned right on site to the really high-end stuff. So yeah, I'm not principally opposed to working on any instrument. And I think, you know, to clarify a little bit on that perspective too, I think that taking the approach of, I don't care what piano it is, I'm going to give it everything that it should have. I'm not necessarily going to give it everything it should have, but I'm going to let the client know everything that it should have. And that, again, it doesn't matter to me if it's a Lester Spinet or Fazioli. It's, they will know how their piano can be made better when I leave their that first appointment. They're going to know, they're going to have a roadmap to making it the best piano it can be. And they're also going to have an understanding of whether or not that's even advisable. You know, if it's a Lester Spinet, I would be hard pressed to find a time that I would say it's worth investing anything in that piano. And most clients, if you had that piano, one of the things I share with them is, you know, if you came to me with this piano, or if you were looking to buy a piano and you came to me and said, hey, what do you think about this one? I tell you, no, it just run away, go find something better. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with being blunt with our clients in that way, so long as we're diplomatic about it. And I think it's, our role is to deliver information, to educate unapologetically, but with sensitivity to their situations, but not tell them they have something that they don't, and not pretend that it can be something that it can't. And so I think when you're really honest about that, then you don't have to worry about this idea of, you know, I'm fleecing my customers just because I can, because that's not what we're doing. We're educating them and we're letting them decide how they want to handle their situation.
Let's go back to the chat here. Chris Browns is following up, said he finds that many people have their mother's well-worn and not top quality piano. That means the world to them. They don't mind putting money into it. I'll visit this topic briefly just because it came up here from Bruce Gibson. It's a little bit left term, but he visited your website and he said, it looks like you're using Gazelle. Is that something that you're using in terms of,
yes.
And he just wanted to know your experience a little bit, please. We don't have to dwell on it, but.
Sure. Yeah. I started using Gazelle probably 2 years ago. The short version is I love it. It's really streamlined my workflow. And again, because I don't have a secretary, nobody's answering phones for me. It's really made my record keeping part of my business so much better. It really has improved things a lot. I hesitated. I didn't get on the train the first 3 years that Gazelle was out. I liked the idea of it, but a big part of what we do is interpersonal stuff, communicating with our clients on a very personal level. And I was concerned that removing yet one more element of communication by automating, you know, the reminders and that kind of a thing was going to make my clients feel that I was less invested, that I was more detached from them. And I can say unequivocally that clients appreciate being able to self-schedule. They love being able to do that on their own. They appreciate the automated reminders. It's been a positive experience for me.
Great. Thanks for sharing. If people want to hear more about that, just chime up in the chat. I'll go on to the next point. To Carl's point, this is from Eric Johnson, manufacturers and dealers are part of the industry ecosystem. Rebuilding some POS hurts those parts of the industry on which we depend. Okay, interesting. And from Bill Yick said, our reputation is important. If a client insists on a rebuild of a Brand X P&O, then a written acknowledgement from the client is an appropriate step to take. They were informed of other options, educated about the value, etc. That is one way to protect yourself. I don't know if to go to that extreme, but it could be. Have you ever done that?
No, I haven't done anything like that. One of the things that I have embraced in this business also is that what we do is based so strongly in a relationship of trust. And we have to develop that relationship of trust with our clients, and they can sniff it out. They know. They have a sense, they have a feeling of whether you're being straight with them about the things that you're talking about. And as long as we are forthright, as long as we are honest in our presentations and you know, don't promise them things that we cannot deliver on, I've been fine. I won't say that would never happen, that you won't have people out there like that, especially in today's litigious society. It's a possibility that something like that could come along, but I guess I felt the way that I do business is still kind of old school, I guess, in that way, and it's based on trust. It's based on a handshake, essentially. I do have clients sign contracts for larger jobs, just committing to that job, but that's about as far as I go for commitments on things. And then I underpromise and I try my best to overdeliver. And you know, that combined with honesty goes a long way. A colleague of mine once said something one time a couple of years ago about the work that we do, and it's a statement that stuck with me will stick with me forever. And the gist of it was, if you tell the truth, you don't have to remember what you said, and that comes up so often in my work life, and that what I thought a year ago about a particular piano may not be what I think about it today. And having a different perspective today is okay, as long as I was being honest before, and as long as I'm being honest now, that my perspective has changed, that's an okay thing. And in fact, I think it's probably a good thing, because it shows we're continuing to learn and develop our own set of skills as well.
Strong opinions loosely held. That's a famous I forget who said that, but it's an interesting way to go about things, and many have argued for it. A.B. Chase, this is from Susan Klein. Poor man Steinway. I wasn't familiar with A.B. Chase at all. This is interesting. They were such exact copies that Steinway sued them. She worked with a church to partially rebuild a beat-up 7-foot A.B. Chase. Steve Gantz found that they even copied the strike line problem in the first capo section. Turned out great. Okay, yeah, that's interesting. David says, can a Steinway have fall board appeal if it's refinished, as in decals? If you're doing boards, how do you handle humidity in your shop? So it looks like that's two questions. I'm not exactly sure what it means, what the...
I understand that. So yeah, the first question, I think, is because of the recent position Steinway has taken on giving out or selling decals for their instruments, whether for the fall board or the sound boards. And that presented some challenges for us as rebuilders. My understanding is we can still get them. I had purchased a head before I even found out Steinway was going to be having a problem. I keep decals in stock. And again, I'm a one-person shop, so I mean, if I turn out 3 rebuilds in a year, that's a busy, busy year for me, because I'm still out working, tuning, and doing everything else too. So I don't have to go through a lot of my decal stuff. But that's potentially a problem. If you can't get a decal for your Steinway, for at least for the fall board, that will have an impact. And I think, that's something where we need to be upfront with our clients. If we can't get a decal for whatever reason, then they need to know that before we sign any papers for a restoration job that way. But again, like I said, I'm pretty sure at this point you can communicate with Steinway and you can get the appropriate decals for your piano, so long as they're assured it's going to stay Steinway kind of thing. The second question on humidity control in the shop, it's I'm always humidity controlled. So this space, I monitor and maintain humidity with a relatively large dehumidification unit here in the summer. And then I run a couple of mid-sized humidifiers in the wintertime so that my relative humidity stays exceptionally constant throughout the summers as well as throughout the winters. I vary it a little bit seasonally. So in the summer, I tend to allow things to float a little bit. I'm maintaining about 50-51% here in the summer. Wintertime, I'll try and keep it up to about 40% in the wintertime. That works pretty well.
Do you ever run into any issues with being too organized?
No. No. That's good. That's not a problem I've dealt with. I'm sorry, Lay. I say that flippantly, but no, I think it's a legitimate question, and I think you can run into problems. In fact, one of the articles that I wrote recently in the journal, I don't even remember what the article was, if it's been published or not, but one of the photographs I used showed this pile of parts that I was getting to, and I very purposefully used this photograph to show this. Like, I was doing one operation to all of these parts which were removed from an upright piano. I have parts racks that organize everything. So when I take things off, they're numbered, they're ordered, everything looks pretty at every step of the job. And like when it's out of line, I hate it. I can't stand it. It drives me bonkers and I gotta line everything up. And there was a point where I realized, and it's still a work in progress, I still don't make piles of things like that picture showed, but you can really slow yourself down trying to be that organized when you just don't have to. If you're doing a whole series of operations on these parts, and then like in this case, it was doing X and then they move to a different pile and then doing Y and then move them back and then doing Z. So all these parts had to get the same things done. I would have wasted a tremendous amount of time trying to keep them on the rack, trying to keep standing up straight and all of that other thing, as opposed to just doing the operation, putting it in a pile, doing an operation, putting it in a pile and moving back and forth that way. And then when I was done, they're numbered and you hang them up and you can put them back on the instrument. So I do think you want to, it is something to pay attention to in your workflow and your processes and making sure that you're seeing the forest for the trees and you're not just diddling around wasting time. If you drop a box of punchings, for heaven's sakes, just sweep them up and throw them away or put them in the recycle and open a new bag of punchings. I say that, and yet I've swept them up and started sorting and cleaning them. I'm my mother's child. I can't waste things. I hate it. I recognize, but I'm very clear with myself. When I do something like that and drop all my punchings and then sort them out, now I'm in hobby land. This is my hobby now. I'm sorting parts and I'm not, it's not part of my professional ethic because it's a huge waste of time and money to try and figure that stuff out. So yeah, I think it's a good question. And I think it does bear paying attention to that. You're not just wasting time to be organized.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. Thanks for putting some serious thought into that one. Yeah. I was making a little bit of a joke, but there's definitely some places to explore. Next thing I see here in the chat, thanks for all the questions, folks, by the way. This, I really love it when people get engaged, so thank you so much. And there's a ton more we could chat about. I will just note, you did bring up the PTG journal and articles and things. If we get to it, maybe just chat a little bit about that. But next thing here is, do you rebuild pianos on spec or only for clients? I do about 50-50, but have the spec pianos for quite a while.
Yeah, that's a good question. I in theory, I do both. In reality, I rebuild for clients. So I, like most piano rebuilders, I have an affliction, which is when something good presents itself, it's tough to say no, and my shop starts getting overrun with high quality carcasses that are waiting to be rebuilt. So, you know, right now in my shop, which is just, it's not that big. My shop's about 20 by 40 is all the space that I have. And I've got 7 pianos of my own in here right now. And I've got a couple more coming back in. I'm not working on any of my spec pianos because I am very busy with my tuning work. I'm very busy with client restoration work. So the spec pianos are here. They're great pianos, a couple of Steinways, a couple of Masons, old Blüthner, and things like that. They're really fabulous projects, and I hope to get to them one day. But so long as I'm busy working on client instruments, that's where I focus, because it's so much better to be working on a job that you know you're getting paid for than working on a job that you're hoping to get paid for. So absolutely keep spec pianos here. And you know, when COVID hit, that was a great time. I pulled down a Steinway O and started working on that when COVID hit, because I was out of work for 2 months, not allowed to be out in the field. And that gave me an opportunity to do something productive with my time, in something that is very likely going to have good return on it. But yeah, I don't want to depend upon that kind of a thing if there's paid work to be done.
Yeah, that makes sense. I was going to move on to the next one here. Let's see. How about a cost? Oh, no, actually, I had a question. Sorry, blanked a little bit. Spec. Does that mean speculation, like a speculative investment? Or what does the spec stand for? Excuse my ignorance.
Just speculating that it's going to sell. So
exactly.
I buy the piano, it's a carcass, I rebuild it, and then it's up to me to sell it.
Right, got it. Okay, thanks for clarifying there. Clark Renard posted a general question here. How about costs of rebuilding a C. Bechstein? Did you have any thought? He said, how about costs of rebuilding a C. Bechstein? I'm not sure if there's a answer for that, but.
Yes, there will be. yeah, I'm not sure what the question is.
He might clarify.
You know, yeah, I mean, I think it doesn't matter what the piano is. Every piano is assessed independently, whether it's a Bechstein, a Blüthner, a Henry Miller, or Steinway. You know, they all have their own costs associated with them. You know, some jobs with the Henry Miller that I did a few years back had four different levels to the pin block. Was one single pin block, but it had four different steps to it that had to be shaped and formed. And that was a very complex fitting operation, which we were not good about figuring out ahead of time. And that ended up costing us a little more money to do that on us, because we weren't well prepared. But so that, I think that's the heads up for any of that work, is just making sure that either you're familiar enough with the instrument to know what you're getting into so that you can price it accordingly, or making sure you're very diligent in your assessments so that you know what to expect.
I'm going to go a little rapid fire here because there's some questions to catch up to, and I'm going to jump to the end. When you have someone else do the refinishing, let me skip over this one. Can you talk about, this is a private question to me, can you talk a little bit about carbon fiber replacement action parts? Do you use them, and when do you recommend them?
Sure. I do use them. I love the Wesson, Lookill & Gross parts. I love the company. They've been very good to work with. Great service before and after selling the parts to you. Yeah, I really enjoy them. I think from a performance perspective, from a regulation perspective, they're fantastic parts to have. I always present them as an option to clients, and I discuss the valid perspective that, for example, if you're rebuilding a Steinway, some people care that the parts are all Steinway, some don't. If you are looking at a Steinway that you may be reselling in the future, you need to be aware of that difference. It's a valid point, because some buyers will be turned off by non-Steinway parts. Others, it's not going to affect them. So again, as long as people are aware, yeah, I absolutely put them out there as an option for every rebuild.
Yeah, and it sounds like you don't specifically always recommend them. You say, here's an option, and then you can choose whether you want it or not. Any situation where you would highly recommend it?
In pianos? I think there's some real advantages to composite parts. And when I present them as an option, that's part of the presentation is, you know, what are the pluses and minuses of composite parts versus traditional wood parts versus original manufacturer's parts. So all of those things are on the table with those various perspectives. Like I said, from a performance perspective, they're second to none to me. I enjoy working with them, and I feel like they're they're as good or better than anything out there.
Great. Clark Renard followed up. He said his understanding of European parts is that they cost more for a C. Bechstein rebuild. Also, plates can be cracked. That sounds like a big headache. Have you dealt with cracked plates?
Cracked plates are always a concern with the Bechsteins. And quite frankly, they can be concerned with any instruments for a variety of reasons, and whether it's from notorious casting flaws of Bechstein, or sometimes you have issues where, and you don't find it, unfortunately, until you start taking a plate out, and you find out how much a plate has been flexed or bent in the process of putting it in. There's lots of things that can come up that way. And yeah, cracked plates, I'm fortunate I've only come across one in my career so far. And that one actually wasn't cracked all the way through. It was on an upright piano. And that's a whole nother topic. It's still in performance today. It's still being used in a tuned spine, staple as anything. But different topic.
All right. Now, a couple of this sort of a similar topic here from Ron and Dorothy. When unexpected difficulty comes up, do you stick with the original estimate? And basically, same question, how do you handle surprises not included in the estimate? Great question.
Sure. When I write my estimates, I have clauses at the end of the contracts always that will complete jobs to within 5% of the original cost. So I always put a buffer in there for myself for just such occasions. Having said that, I made the mistake of utilizing that clause once, probably 15 years ago. And the experience that I had with that was enough negative that I do everything in my power to stay on budget, to not exceed the cost of the original estimate. One other tactic that I will use is estimate for things that I know could potentially be problems. For example, stripped action rails on Steinways is a fairly common thing. Doesn't always need to be addressed, but it may need to be addressed. Sometimes you can figure that out prior to disassembly. If all the screws are turning and nothing's staying tight, then you know you've got a problem. But you don't necessarily know if the brass is cracked until you get all the hammers off and all the strip of listing cloth off to expose the brass. And then you find out you've got a cracked rail that needs to be replaced. So a lot of times my estimates will include things like replacing those brass rails. And then we find after the fact we didn't need it, so that comes off the cost. So I would rather estimate high, come in low, and like I said, make every effort to stay on budget. And sometimes things come up that are legitimate that you really could not have prepared for. And if that's the case, even if I'm staying within my 5%, I'm going to have a conversation with the client about that and just try and keep them as informed as possible all along the way.
I like to approach things that way too. I like to make sure that the client knows how deep it might go before we even get started. And that way you can deal with those surprises. If you charge them less than they expected, it's so funny. It's psychology, you know, it's like somebody pays the same amount, but if beforehand they thought it was going to be more, they're great. And if beforehand they thought it would be less, they're really upset. We're coming up on the time here, so I want to give us a chance to wind down. I this has been rapid fire, and Bill, I appreciate, you know, David's not here today, and I feel like he adds a little bit more kind of just friendly, kind of fun energy to things that kind of drove right into you, just drilled you with questions. So I appreciate you just kind of taking the question seriously and responding. I'm just curious, before we sign off soon, anything that you wanted to share just with folks, since you have the hot seat here?
I'll just say first, this is great. It's been a lot of fun fielding the questions and being able to kind of share my perspective of how I tend to move through these jobs and my approach to the work that I do. There's really nothing, I guess, that I feel like I really want to add to the overall picture. I just, like I said early on, I really believe strongly in this idea of, you know, education as being the primary component of what we do as piano technicians with our clients, so that we're not on the hot seat for making decisions. We let the decisions be theirs. We just make sure that we've given them the right information and all the information to make their choices with. And if we do that, then I feel like we've done our job. And if they choose to do something that maybe we wouldn't choose to do, that's okay, because it's, you know, it's similar to voicing. And if left unguided, I have a voicing palette, a tonal palette that I'm after, and that's how I'm going to voice an instrument, and that might not be what they want to hear. So, you know, that if somebody wants something really bright and brash, despite my best recommendations otherwise, that's not my choice. That's what they want, their piano, up to them. So, yeah, it's education and then over well, how is that phrase? I'm having trouble saying that phrase now. Under promise and over deliver.
Under promise and over deliver.
Yeah, like you said, it's better to come in under budget than come in over budget anytime.
Great. Well, thanks. That's a good note to end on. Very sage advice, brother. Very sage advice, brother. I've been advised to call you brother in David's place today to bring his spirit to the conversation.
I was going to say, it's just been my pleasure. And also, I'm very accessible online. If folks have questions that they really would like more answers to or like my perspective on, I'm more than happy to field emails or what have you. It's fun for me to kind of share my perspective. And you know, again, it's just one perspective of one rebuilder doing what I do in the Midwest.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So we'll sign off in a minute here. I put some links in the chat for folks if you want to check out next week's episode. I've got links for that. If you want to register for Piano Tech Masterclasses to see some educational content that we've got, that's great. And I also put a link there to the podcast, which is now being released. We're going back to previous episodes and making some podcast episodes out of those so that you can put them on in the shop while you're working or driving around in the car, so you can check out their podcast too. And with that, I will pretty much sign us off. I want to say thanks again to Bill. Just leave your computer open for a second so that the recording can finish. And beyond that, I'll just say thanks to everyone and we'll catch you later. We'll see you next time.
Yeah, hey. Go ahead. One last thing, Ethan, if you want, I put my email address in the chat. I don't know if you want to put that up on Facebook link or whatnot, so people can get a hold of me if they want to.
Okay, that sounds great. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thanks, everybody.
See y'all later. Just leave your computer open for a second so that the recording can finish. And beyond that, I'll just say thanks to everyone and we'll catch you later. We'll see you next time.
Yeah, hey, go ahead. One last thing, Ethan, if you want, I put my email address in the chat. I don't know if you want to put that up on Facebook link or whatnot, so people can get a hold of me if they want to.
Okay, that sounds great. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thanks, everybody.
See y'all later.
Thank you so much for giving us an hour of your time. Remember that you can catch us live online every Saturday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time.
That's right. Go to pianotechradio.com to register so you can interact live and ask questions of our guests.
See you next week.
Hey, folks. Ethan here with a quick but thrilling commercial interruption. On April 18th at 3 p.m. Pacific Time, 6 p.m. Eastern, we are hosting a masterclass on action geometry with the renowned Dean Rayburn. We host these masterclasses pretty much every third Thursday of every month. You don't want to miss them. You don't want to miss this one. This masterclass will be two extensive parts. Part one will dive into the basics of grand piano action geometry. You can master meticulous measurement techniques to determine radial arms, key ratios, and understand important calculations. In part two, you can apply your knowledge to real-world piano action problems. Dean demonstrates practical solutions, including the magic line concept and hammer weight reduction methods. Key features of this lecture include hands-on style learning with Dean Rayburn, a titan of the piano industry, in-depth coverage of action geometry principles and problem-solving techniques, real-world application through troubleshooting and solution demonstrations, and expert insights from Dean Rayburn. That's 45 years of experience in the piano industry. Dean is a seasoned RPT, certified tuning examiner, and a lifelong piano aficionado. With Dean, you are certainly learning from the best. So don't forget to sign up. Visit bit.ly/pianoaction for more details and secure your spot. That's bit.ly/pianoaction, bit.ly/pianoaction.